This is the 6-1, and so what I thought to do, it's the last one, but because it's the sixth one, is not really to say as much on the final part, but sort of to summarize what we've learned about the Trinity and discussed, and that way, I don't really think anybody's going to go back and listen to all six of these. I couldn't see that unless one of us was maybe teaching on it or something. It might be useful then as a refresher. But so this last one will sort of provide that, like if you wanted to go back and see what we basically got, since it's six of them, you just go back to this last one. And so I would even listen to it, because I'm about to read basically the summary, you know, it's probably worth $50, just the summary on this page here. So it'll be sort of monologue at first, but then the part we're going to talk about today be more discussion. But so hopefully this will get you back sat down on the side of the lake and your feet in the water and looking out at what we've been looking at. So the first one we had, we called the starting point, and that's where we saw that the Trinity was not birthed by super heavenly minded men, but actually very earthly minded men, fishermen. And it was literally born in the birth of Christ, the historical event of his birth, and brought fully to incubation and the outpouring of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost. And so it's really about as down to earth as you can get, as down to earth as placenta, so is the doctrine of the Trinity. And so another way of saying that, the gospel is the announcement, of course, of the coming of Christ and all that he did, and also of the Spirit. You know, Peter, repent and you'll receive the Spirit. So the Spirit is part of the gospel proclamation. And so these two things basically mean, real simple, no Trinity, no gospel. You can't possibly have the gospel. Now, you can unconsciously have it. That's what we were saying. You may not realize fully what you've embraced by believing in the coming and living and dying and rising of Jesus and the outpouring of the Spirit, but the puzzle pieces are all there. And so that was the first point, that the starting point is not philosophers for the Trinity. And so it often gets that name for being very high-minded, and we'll just be simple Christians. And so it's good to know it was simple Christians who started this. The second one then, the turning point, is it, in light of the fact that it was the Trinitarian doing and acting of God that led the church to it, so they turned to it. And when they turned to it, to sort of gaze at this burning bush, we made the observation there, is where we slid in this language of the traditional language of the economical and ontological Trinity. You know, the acts of God in history that indicate the acts of God in eternity. Other phrases that's been used, it's his ad intro, these Latin phrases, the works of God within the being of God versus outside in the universe. And so we use some different words there, the historical and eternal. But, anyhow, in turning to that, the church somehow saw that God is one in three. So from the gospel, we turn to the scriptures, and somehow he's one in three. They went back into their Old Testaments, and lo and behold, God creates the world through his word, by his spirit. There's a threefold cause of creation, and he redeems Israel with the angel of the Lord and dwells in the temple by his spirit. So there's a threefold cause of redemption. Even providence is given a threefold cause. God is obviously Lord of history, but through his word and Job, if he should pull forth his breath, the whole thing would go apart. But the thing that they noticed was in the Old Testament, his word was personal and his spirit was personal. But in the New Testament, the full flower is his word is person. And the spirit is person. So that now if you lie to the spirit, you've lied to God. And so that's what they saw. And that sort of set up this whole story of church history and what do we think about the Trinity. It set the tension, if you will, crying out for resolution as to how God could be one and three. And so we went there to the way that people have answered that question wrongly, the defending point. And you know, there's always the two ditches here. You can emphasize the oneness of God to the exclusion of the threeness, and that was basically Arianism. And and then you can emphasize the threeness at the expense of the oneness, and that's basically Sabellianism or modalism. They eliminate the three. Arianism eliminates the oneness of the three. And so instead we saw through Athanasius and all that going on, the church basically said in that time period, here's what we can do. We can fence in the mystery. We may not know what it is, but we know what it's not. And so that's an important thing to bring out, that we don't fully know what. And here's where the truly, fully principle begins to pay big dividends to us, because we begin to see it worked out here, that we don't know God fully, but only truly. So we went there to the fourth one, the squinting point, confining ourselves to sort of looking within this fence, squinting our eyes as much as we can. That kind of happened in church history after that. And so the things that they could say that they saw was first, the identity of Father, Son, and Spirit was not arbitrary, they said, but was based on the eternal activity in the three persons. So what designates the Father as the Father is his relation to the Son as a Father. And what designates the Son as the Son is his relation to the Father as a Son. And what designates the Spirit or the breath as the breath is that the Father and the Son breathe out or spirate or sigh the Spirit outpoured on each other. And so that was the first thing they observed, is that these names were baptized in the name of Father, Son, and Spirit. And that's not arbitrary. It's not like the Son could have been called the Father. And so there are reasons for it. The second thing is they began to use a person for the threeness and being for the oneness. Those terms came in. Of course, we have them in our hymns, you know, God in three persons, Blessed Trinity. And the third thing is some took their cue from the N language we looked at last time. Gospel of John, the Father is in the Son, the Son is in the Father. And these thinkers, these theologians, lit the lamp and went deeper into the mystery with this and saw that basically God's not three in one, but three in one. And each person penetrates the other person and lives in the other person. So God's not like three marbles brought together. It is one life shared by each person, so that the Father is fully God, the Son is fully God, the Spirit is fully God. Whatever the divine nature and essence is, the Son has it, the Spirit has it, the Father has it, and yet Father's not the Son, so forth and so on. But like I said, it's a wonderful answer, and about the we looked into it, but really, did it solve the tension, or did it just raise a new question of, well, how can God be three in one? And there's, what does that look like? And so I said, well, far as I can tell, no thinker has been able to unpack that for us. So we're kind of left listening to Clint Eastwood, A Man's Got to Know His Limitations. And apparently that's as far as we can squint. The last one we had was the loving point, because nevertheless that in language did it did answer one long-standing question that had been asked early on, is why must God be more than one person? And it pointed out that the answer they gave was that God is love. And so there's always been, that's of course from 1 John 4. And of course, in context, the love that he's attributing to God there, that's from God there, is not just any kind of love. It's a one another kind of love. And it's the love that we see on the cross. And he's saying that kind of love, that kind of self-giving love, is part of God's being and nature and who he really is, so that you could say someone that doesn't live like Christ does not know God. And you can give two reasons. Well, he's not imitating Christ on the cross, and the other is he don't know who God is. Because the preeminent revelation on the cross is telling us the deepest fact about him, that is who he is right there. That self-giving and loving his neighbor as himself. And so we put it this way, or I did, that God is love could basically means that God is in love. So far in love that all three persons are literally in one another, fully indwelling one another. Made me think perhaps this is why we doubt love from one another, whether it's in a marriage, in a relationship, a kid, a friend, church member, fellow brother, sister, the more distance is put between us. Like no one struggles with slander while they're laughing, eating food together. You know, it happens when there's distance and they have a conversation with somebody else, and I wasn't included on that, and I'm over here. And then it just starts to feel, it made me think that that right there is actually perhaps a faint echo, an image of God there that we're imaging there, that the Father, Son, and the Spirit are never like that. They're never apart. And so distance and a lack of love seem to go together. And we talk like that, you know, put space between us. The second reason that was given historically was the self-consciousness of God, and that he's a self-aware being, that more than one person is required for there to be divine thought. And obviously that's because, where am I at here? To think, one has to distinguish between itself and the thing it's thinking about, which means distinguishing has to be an eternal attribute of God, or else there is no divine thought. So the Father knows himself to be the Father and not the Son and not the Spirit, and vice versa, all the way it goes. An amazing thing to think about. And it's really amazing to me to think about it in union here with this love thought, because I mean, one thing's amazing to think about is the reason that I know me right now is me, and Justin is Justin, and Mr. Ford is Mr. Ford, is because in eternity there was divine thought. Otherwise, it would never exist right now in this very moment. And that's just an amazing thought. But as I thought about it in relation to the whole love thing, is This explains, to me anyway, this was a new thought this time around, as I thought about the self-consciousness and the inner penetration, that this shows the perfection and completeness and beauty and blessedness of God. Let me just read what I wrote here. Finally, this explains the utter completeness and perfectness of the divine love. Each person is involved in a relationship of such intimacy that they literally exist inside one another, but not to the point of completely losing each other, so that they retain their own self-awareness and can actually enjoy the love between them. Literally, they completely give themselves away without fully losing themselves. In intimacy, they fully give themselves into the other. In identity, yet retaining themselves so that they can still experience the whole thing as a self. So this is, I think, reflected in creation. In creating something went out from God without God losing anything. If I may dare say it, on the cross, he gave himself away without losing himself. Yeah. And all of this is because each person of the Trinity is apparently so brimful of existence that they can give themselves without losing themselves. So rich is God that he gives away his riches without becoming poor. And to be in this triune relationship is to be in the most amazing possible love relationship ever. It's not even available to us. Some of these thoughts I have to keep to myself, but, you know, even between a man and a woman, sometimes if the love is really, if the love there is really, if they're blessed with like a really extreme love relationship, sometimes even at the climax of that, there's still a sense of lack. Like there's still a sense of, if I can dare to say it, a part of you not in them that wants to be in them, or a part of them not in you that wants to be in you. And it's something that's only available to God. It's something that only Jonathan Edwards then rightly called God the best of all beings, and greater than which nothing can ever be imagined.
We can never fully know.
We can't fully know ourselves.
How will we fully know somebody else?
Yeah.
A relationship that never diminishes, that never decreases. It's fully 100% on steroids and autopilot of being fully in love. I don't even know.
I was counting on you talking a little bit more.
Okay. Well,
can we share?
Yeah, we can. And this is a stopping point, by the way. I just have a tiny bit to share for today to finish it. So we have a caboose coming, and that's it.
I guess it's been way back, maybe earlier in the series, but it made me think of it. I like to hear the thought again of how the son, he never left the Trinity when he came down to earth in the flesh. So all these things you're describing, the son was still in his same role.
Still in,
but like extending himself. I heard somebody put it that way one time. He extended himself down in the form of a man. So he was like, I don't know how to put that in words, but he came down as in the flesh, but he never left the Trinity. Because I've had some people bring that up. Apparently it's like is it one issue that? Where they'll say, well, I've heard the question like, well, where was Jesus? Like, was Jesus in heaven? I'm sorry, when he went to the tomb, where was it? Like, when those 3 days, was he, did he not exist? I think we may have covered that. Anyway, I just mentioned your thoughts. We're talking about the oneness.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't know what to say there other than to talk about his humanity. As far as his deity goes, he's the incorruptible, unchanging God. Like, no piece of dirt in creation can ever be thrown into the pure fountain of the Trinity. Like, can't be spoiled, can't be damaged, can't be hurt, can't be destroyed. So obviously, in that sense, no, the son's never been wrenched out of the relationship of the Father and the Spirit. Matter of fact, in John 16, he says that the time has come for all of you to forsake me and leave me alone, but I'm not alone. The Father is with me. So, which is kind of interesting because it's looking forward to the time that he was going to be forsaken by them. So in some sense, he was there. Hebrews 9, I think 26 it is, says he, through the eternal Spirit, offered himself without blemish to God. So the Spirit was right there participating in the sacrifice. I don't really know what to say. I mean, that the oneness mindset is so many wires are loose. Biblical wiring is so off there that I don't even know if you could deal with it by answering that question. Like they kind of got to go outside to the main electrical pole and go to work there. But
I think we just know the two things, that he was fully man, the God man.
Yeah.
But he never left the Trinity.
Never. Yeah. Never. Yeah.
It's quite easy to understand.
Mercy be understanding.
Yeah.
This is bottom shelf stuff.
Yeah. So for this week, the final thing that we want to end on is, if I try to alliterate this, or I would call it the wondering point, and just I hope this is what's the grief to me, is not only is it lost people and kind of nominal Christians and people that feel threatened by theology and kick against it with, like, oh, I'm just a simple man, all that. But people in the church even can give off this impression that you're high-minded and buy into this lie about looking into these things. Like you were just saying, it's sarcastically, it's bottom level. No, it's top level stuff. But God has given us hands to reach the top shelf, too. So if it's like, we're not ants. Like, we're made in His image. And we can conceive of it and think about it. And it's literally in the Bible. Like, this language of being in, that didn't come from Boethius or somebody. It's right there written by John the fisherman. And so, I hope these reflections can create a sense of childlike wonder. For example, Augustine was the one that came up with this this phrase, vestiges of the Trinity. And he wrote a whole, I'd love to read it one day. I don't know if it's translated out of Latin into English, but he probably the first major worthwhile book of supreme importance and edifying it's called De Trinitate, but it's written in Latin. I haven't looked up to see if there is an English copy, but quotes and things I've seen through it. He goes through, he coins this term, vestiges of the Trinity, like this imprint of the Trinity everywhere, like everything in creation somehow reflecting the Trinity. I just want to read to you, like, maybe a paragraph or something of the kind of mind it can create in you, and then something, a little sample of some things I had wrote down when we preached on it. This is Herman Bavinck. He says, he says, the doctrine of the Trinity is so far above human understanding that from the time it was first formulated, attempts have been made to elucidate it by illustrations and prove it by argumentation. Remarkable in the first place is that the number three had such rich and deep significance in Scripture. There we read of the three parts of creation, heaven, earth, and what is under the earth. Three ethnic groupings originating from the three sons of Noah. three dispensations of the covenant of grace, before, under, and after the law, the three patriarchs, the three divisions of the tabernacle, the three great feasts, the three parts of the Old Testament law, prophets, and writings, the 3 years of Christ's public ministry, the three offices of Christ, prophet, priest, and king, the 3 days in the grave before the resurrection, the three crosses on Golgotha, the three languages which Pilate wrote on the wood above the tree, the three beloved disciples, the three witnesses in 1 John 5, the three prime Christian virtues of faith, hope, and love, the three lusts of the flesh, 1 John 2:16, the three woes of Revelation 8, the threefold benediction, the threefold action and greeting and blessings, the 3 days of fasting, three daily periods of prayer, and so on. Then people have come to nature. They have, just from the very beginning, church fathers have gone through these images of the root and the fruit and the light, the spring and the flood and the stream, these images, the sun being both light and heat and light coming out from it. All these images have been used. Space, matter, time, and space, the three dimensions. The body existed in a solid, fluid, and gaseous state. The rainbow, the three primary colors, yellow, red, and blue. The harmony of music. Just on and on and on. He's just got lists of stuff here, just lists and lists and lists and lists. Things I pointed out before is the one and the many. You cannot find one thing in the whole universe that doesn't have variety. There's not just one cloud. We got this kind of cloud and this kind of cloud. And there's not just one kind of grass. There's not one kind of bird. There's not even one kind of fingernail. A pine tree is literally a work of art of like a harmony of these pieces just put together. Like, that exists around that tree because God's a Trinity. That's why that's there. Vestiges of the Trinity just left all over creation. The family unit has been used, a man, a woman, and a child. Just on and on and on things have been used. And the irony of the whole thing is this practical childlike wonder is generated from the Trinity when so-called childlike humble people don't want to talk about it. It's the thing that turns you into a kid again. And it's literally the lifeblood of the whole Christian faith. Every heresy can be traced to it. Every single heresy can be traced to it. Things like doctrine and life. Well, there's doctrine and life in God. The Son is the doctrine of the deity. The Spirit is the affections going out toward the doctrine. So Martin Lloyd-Jones says, preaching, is logic on fire. Well, God is doctrine on fire. He's a consuming fire, but for what? For his Son, right? So Hebrews calls him a consuming fire. Well, what's that Spirit outraged about? The treatment of the Son. And so there's some of these you've been through. There couldn't be any morality unless God's a Trinity. There is no reason for there to be a multi-personal ethic in anyone's conscience on the face of the earth unless God's Trinity. There is no, and it just is there. There's no reason it wouldn't be there. I mean, evolution can't explain it. It'd be better for evolution if I didn't have a conscience. I could kill you and not feel bad about it. You know? So why is it there? It's not a product of that. Let's see. We've been through this one. Think of this. There could have never even been a creation at all unless there was already movement within the divine being. Like, God would have never moved to do anything else. There would never even been movement without the love going on between them. I mentioned music. Anything else that I have? This should change the way we view his attributes. It's no longer, the power of God becomes the arm of love and the strength of love, and the knowledge of God becomes the eye of love. You know, like just thinking of these attributes existing in this love relationship. Anything else that I haven't mentioned? Like, autism will one day be defeated because God's a Trinity. Like, God is not a single person existing over here by himself. So all of this that breaks down that relationship, the last chapter is not that. And how do I know that? God's a Trinity. So, you know, the middle of the night and the worst day possible, like, what's the doctrine that gives comfort to the mother with her autistic child? The Trinity. You know, so again, the irony, loneliness, like I have three people who are always inviting me over. Like, I'm always invited to the Trinity. So I may not have this, I may not have that, I may not be able to go there, I may miss out on that. But I can go for a walk and pray anytime. I can read my Bible anytime. I can know God anytime. So I think the Trinity should create, you know, there are reservations to have about these, you know, like don't, these are vestiges of the Trinity. So these analogies don't properly point for point, you know, explain the truth. So, like, we can't use water, you know, solid liquid gas. Well, that's not right, because God's not at one time this way and that way. You know, three-leaf clover. Well, the Father's not part of God. You know, they don't. So I think it's best to go with the scriptural image of love. That's the image we're given. And somehow the Father, Son, and Spirit exist. You can go Google and read Jonathan Edwards' essay on the Trinity if you want to. You'll be sitting there thinking, what is he talking about? But you can go read it if you want to. He pulls very interesting scriptures together. One I'm thinking of, like, he just pulls stuff like Romans 5:5, the hope does not disappoint because the love of God is poured out within our hearts by the Holy Spirit who is given to us. And he'll draw a conclusion, you know, that obviously the love of God is the outpouring of the Spirit of God, things like that. They're rooted in biblical reflections. It's called an essay on the Trinity. But that's all I have. We've only, there's obviously an ocean out there, and we're just dangling our feet in the water to get a feel for it. And
about it.
Any final thoughts? Or I know you had something you were supposed to share with us, huh, Mr. Corey?
Last week? I don't know, we might not want it on tape.
Yeah, before I get shamed.